Okay, tonight's our last series of the year, Fundamental Feuds, the role of machloket, of debate in Jewish life. And I'm guessing as a psychiatrist, you probably see your fair share of clients in cases of machloket and debate. I don't know, I just felt like this might be an issue that you'd be passionate about. Okay, great. And I think we all have our experiences of machloket, of debate and arguments. And tonight's topic is these and these are the words of the living God, which is a famous statement. We'll get into it in a little bit of time. But what I wanted to spend the first part of this, the first class in this series, talking about the philosophy of debate. What's the place of debate in Jewish life? Is it a positive? Is it a negative? I think some of these questions we might have assumptions for, but reviewing the obvious is sometimes worthwhile in and of its own right. And when I was thinking about how to frame this, I definitely feel I have an aversion to conflict, something that I feel I try to avoid conflict by nature, seem to find my way into it from time to time anyways. I don't know if it's totally, I don't think anyone can avoid it entirely. And as I've been learning more about life, I found that early on, let's say in my marriage with Meir, I would try to avoid any possible conflict. And my thinking was like, if we don't fight, then things are great. But what I realized in time, and I think marriage therapists say this and psychologists say this as well, like to avoid conflict is really to avoid intimacy and vulnerability. And it's such a more powerful way when you know how to have arguments and disputes in an agreeable way. That I think just as that's true for human relationships, it's actually true within our Torah tradition as well. The way we think about machloket, the way we think about debate within the Jewish system is that ultimately it's a necessary part of life. And maybe more than just being necessary, maybe it's actually one of the healthiest things for our relationship with the Torah, with God, and with each other. So that's the series that I wanted to start out with tonight. It's hard to think of a more famous debate. So we're going to do like a famous story. Then go into where debate started in the Jewish tradition. Because machloket as a concept is something that we actually have a starting point for. Not for any arguments, period, but at least for the idea of there being disputes and arguments about the Torah itself. That's really going to be our kind of our focus tonight. And then hopefully by the end we'll get into a theology of debate. What does debate help us access in our experience of God? That's my small ambitions for tonight. But before, it's hard to think about any story of debate that's more famous than the case in the Gemara that's known as Tanuro Shel Achnai, which I think the Women's Beit Midrash has been learning with our community scholar, Michal Kahana. Tanuro Shel Achnai, without getting into the nitty-gritty of it, is a debate between two scholars of the Mishnah. So these are the scholars probably in the late 1st, early 2nd centuries, debating about the ritual purity status of an oven. This is an oven that is made in small pieces and has sand going in between it. The details of it for our purposes tonight aren't super important. What's more important is that Rabbi Eliezer, who was one of the famous rabbis, and at the time had been, I believe, the head of the academy, who was then usurped, but Rabbi Eliezer took a stringent opinion to say that this specific oven was truly an oven and therefore was susceptible to ritual impurity. And Rabbi Yeshua and the other sages disagreed with him. And so you had this situation where it was one sage against numerous sages. And how do you decide what the halacha is? How do you decide on the law when there's a difference of opinions? And so this Gemara goes straight into that question. Terry, would you like to read it for us first? So why don't you read us source one? This is Bava Metzia 59a and b.
And this is known as the oven of Achnai. Mm-hmm. The sages taught, on that day when they discussed this matter, Rabbi Eliezer answered all possible answers in the world to support his opinion, but the rabbis did not accept his explanations from him. After failing to convince the rabbis logically, Rabbi Eliezer said to them, "If the halacha is in accordance with my opinion, this carob tree will prove it. The carob tree was uprooted from its place 100 cubits, and some say 400 cubits." The rabbi said to him, "One does not cite halachic proof from the carob tree." Rabbi Eliezer then said to them, If the halakha is in accordance with my opinion, the stream will prevail. The water in the stream turned backward and began flowing in the opposite direction. They said to him, one does not cite halakha proof from a stream.
I'll pause you there for a second. Were there ever times in which halakhic proof for, let's say, capital T truth was determined by these kinds of actions? What kinds of actions are these? How would you categorize these? Like
nature.
Nature? These are trees jumping thousands of meters or hundreds of meters and streams running counterstream.
Those aren't nature, but I'm saying the carob tree and the stream are nature.
So the carob stream, I think that's actually really intentional, right? The carob tree and the stream are natural things that have their natural way. And what's happening to them?
It's supernatural.
There's something supernatural or miraculous.
Magic.
You know what we used to call these things? Miracles, right? We used to call these things miracles. And how did God used to make himself known? If you look at the Torah, how does God make himself known to man? We just had less than that, we were reading, how does God make himself known to Moses? With a burning bush, with a tree that count against the ways of nature won't get burned despite the fact that it's lit on fire, right? This snash, or inenu ukal, the bush that doesn't get consumed. God makes, the pattern in the Bible, right, is that God makes himself known, and God makes his desires and his truth known through miracles. And so here you have the rabbi of the Mishnah, Rabbi Eliezer, proving his worth, the worth of his opinion, with the same miracles that 1,000 years earlier, one would have expected, would have gone uncontested. So as we're going into this Gemara, there's the simple story itself, but then there's the kind of historical context, right? Which is, how do we find out what God wants out of this world? And it sounds like the answer is no longer miracles. Hold on to that point, because we're going to get back to it later. Okay. So Terry, keep going.
Rabbi Eliezer then said to them, if the halakha is in accordance with my opinion, the walls of the study hall will prove it. The walls of the study hall leaned inward and began to fall. Rabbi Yehoshua scolded the walls and said to them, Torah scholars are contending with each other in matters of halakha. What is the nature of your involvement in this dispute?
Right. If you're not part of the fight, get out of the way. Right? Is the, you know, in a time where you could still talk to the wall and that wasn't totally crazy. Okay, good. So Rabbi Yehoshua intercedes, and let's keep going.
The Gemara relates. The walls did not fall because of the deference due Rabbi Yehoshua, but they did not straighten because of the deference due Rabbi Eliezer. They still remain lenient.
So now the Beit Midrash has these convex walls, kind of half curved but not half straight, which is interesting because it seems like Rabbi Eliezer has found his match in the world of the supernatural, right? Like they half cave in, but then they stop because of Rabbi Yeshua. I'm thinking about the Matrix movies where Mr. Smith and Neo get like head to head and they're both each other's equal. That's okay. Bad reference. That's what I think of with the like Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua bending the laws of nature to either try to get their opinion validated or to stop the validity of the other's opinion. Okay, so let's keep going.
Rabbi Eliezer then said to them, if the halacha is in accordance with my opinion, heaven be proved it. A divine voice emerged from heaven and said, why are you differing with Rabbi Eliezer, as the halakha is in accordance with his opinion in every place that he expresses an opinion?
Yeah. So let's pause there. So we first, Rabbi Eliezer earlier was proving his worth with miracles. And now Rabbi Eliezer is going even a step further. What's a divine voice? This is basically, it's God. I mean, it's basically, I think of this as prophecy, right? This is prophecy that's coming down to everyone. I don't know if this is, boombox prophecy, whether there's a physical voice or whether it's just something that people intuit. I don't really know. I haven't seen a bat kol. That's the Hebrew word. A bat kol is like a dot. It's the daughter of a sound. It's an interesting expression. But some kind of like sound coming down from on high. So he's really invoking God, or at least prophecy, right? The prophetic powers to prove his point. And Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says the famous words.
Stood on his feet and said, it is written, it is not in heaven.
Lo bashamayim hi. This is an interesting verse. It comes from Deuteronomy, where Moses gives his final speech to the Jewish people. And in the middle of this speech, which has a lot of harsh things to say, like, you're going to go into the land of Israel, and you're going to get haughty, and you're going to get fat off the land, and you'll forget about God, and you'll worship idols, and then God's going to kick you out, and you're eventually going to remember God. Like, he gives them this whole kind of speech with, like, prophetic warnings about the future. And then finally, in the middle of the speech, he says, by the way, lo bashamayim hi, this Torah, as much as I say you're going to struggle with it, it's not all the way up in heaven to say that no one can reach it, but it's down here on earth, right? It's something accessible to you, right? Make it your own. Take it. It's yours. It's not overwhelming. It's something that humans can reach and hold on to. So I don't know if the original context of that pasuk was about how you decide the law, but what Rabbi Yeshua does with it, he takes that verse from its original context, and he says, you know what? That's how we decide halacha. Not in heaven, because God didn't keep the Torah for the angels. The angels could ask God what to do, but God brought the Torah down to earth, to human beings. So how do we decide the law? Let's keep going.
The Gemara asks, what is the relevance of the phrase, it is not in heaven, in this context? Rabbi Yirmeya says, since the Torah was already given at Mount Sinai, we do not regard a divine voice, as you already wrote at Mount Sinai in the Torah, after a majority to incline.
Right, so that's the verse, Achrei Rabim Latot, you should lean after the majority. So the way that verse is interpreted there is that you should follow majority rules. And he's applying that to the practice of halacha. If you have a Beit Midrash, you have a study hall, and two rabbis say that the halacha is this way, and five rabbis say that the halacha is that way, you follow the five instead of the two. You go by majority rules. Right? I wonder, like, this is an underpinning of democracy. Torah has, you know, it's not...
Majority rules is not democracy.
Okay.
But
that's fair. Yeah.
Well, there's all sorts of ways that you can have a democracy, but if one group doesn't have any say, then...
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying it's confined to the Beit Midrash.
That's just an argument that the majority rules is actually not democracy, necessarily.
Okay.
So where does it come from? We have that.
Well, we understand that in the United States, but any person who's a group of a minority group understands that majority rules does not constitute a true democratic process.
Okay.
Like when all of us were voting on whether or not Native people should have the right on their sovereign lands to have casinos.
Uh-huh, because we're right, we're placing them in a broader context where they lose
their... Well, they're a minority group, so...
Yeah.
But that's a whole different discussion. I was just saying that's...
Okay, sure. So maybe not democracy, but if you have 5-2 in the Beit Midrash, right, you follow the opinion of the five... of the majority, the larger voice is the rulership, is how we decide halacha. Yeah, Sheldon.
Well, it's just interesting because it seems like the political structure that the Torah talks about is a monarchy. It's not a democracy.
Yeah.
The democracy that applies to this is sort of like people in the Supreme Court, right? Deciding halachic matters.
You're right. It's maybe the judicial system.
It is right.
Yeah, as opposed to, right, because monarchs, at least according to most opinions, are not decided based on voting roles as much as the voice of God, right?
Well, that's the prophet, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
The third branch.
So we're going to talk about what the intersection is between prophecy and this Gemara here, because I think that's actually a major transition, and we'll get there. And let's skip down to the words Rabbi Natan. So this is an amazing story where the Gemara picks up with a postscript or an epilogue at the end of the story. Right. So, Terry, do you want to finish us off with the last four lines?
Sure. Rabbi Natan encountered Elijah the prophet and said to him, what did the Holy One, blessed be he, do at that time when Rabbi Yehoshua issued his declaration? Elijah said to him, the Holy One, blessed be he, smiled and said, my children have triumphed over me. My children have triumphed over me.
And... Yeah, and I think the key word in that sentence, it's an amazing, I mean, the divine humility is this an amazing idea. The Gemara elsewhere says that every place you see God's greatness, so in that same place you see God's humility. Anvatnuto shomakom, the humbleness of God. This is like definitely a moment where I think God's greatness is almost revealed through God's humility of being able to say, you know what? Nitzchuni banai, my children have overtaken me, I think the key term there is chiyech. I think the most important word for me in that line is that God said that smiling, right? Because it's defeat. Right? It's like, this Torah is not mine anymore. In other Midrashic literature, there's this famous story about the angels at Mount Sinai protesting to God, how dare you get this Torah down to human beings? This is a Torah that you've kept up here on earth for 1,000 generations, which goes back 974 generations before the world was created. It's this amazing Gemara, and there's something significant to the idea that in Chazal, the beginning of the world until the giving of Torah is 26 generations, which is the same numerical value of God's name of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. So there's something there also. And then God tells Moshe, if you want this Torah, you better prove yourself. And so Moshe starts going to the angels and saying, well, tell me, what's written in this Torah? And so it says, do not worship. I am God, your Lord, who took you out of Egypt. It's the first. He goes through all the Ten Commandments. And Moshe stares at the angels and says, did God take you out of Egypt? Oh, you never were in Egypt? You were never slaves? That happens to people? Well, then that's our Torah. And he goes through all the commandments and says, do not murder. Are you angels capable of murder? No? Okay, well, we are capable of murder. This is our mitzvah. It's our Torah. He goes through all the Ten Commandments with that argument. And at the end, the angels let Moshe bring the Torah down to earth. And that symbolic, that gesture, and it's really choreographed, right? With this idea of walking down with the tablets and bringing them from the top of the mountain where God meets man and bring them down into man's domain. That imagery is paralleled here, right? With Lo Bashamayim Hi, the Torah is no longer in heaven, and it's up to us to decide how to practice. And so I think this Gemara tells us a lot about how we think about machloket, how we think about debate, right? There seems to be, in this reading of the Gemara, the idea of like a vanquished and a conqueror, right? Debate, machloket, almost seems like a war, doesn't it? There's like a certain, right? There's a certain viciousness almost. I don't want to say that in the sense of violence between Rabbi Eliezer and the other rabbis and Rabbi Yeshua. It's like a desperation to prove his point. When later rabbis talk, modern, even if you go to yeshiva now, you'll hear a shmooze, you'll hear like a speech about how when you learn with a chavruta, the best expression of learning should be milchamta shel Torah, the war of Torah, that you're supposed to really argue out your positions and prove the other person wrong with whatever you got. The famous story. Sounds like dinner.
Yes.
So maybe you practice this. Don't have to go to the Beit Midrash. You can bring the Beit Midrash to your table. There's so many expressions of this within our tradition. One of my favorites is the story of Rabbi Yochanan. Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan is another sage with Reish Lakish in the times of the Gemara. And Reish Lakish used to be abandoned, and then he finds Rabbi Yochanan and he becomes his student partner. And one day, like years later, they're learning together. Rabbi Yochanan reminds Reish Lakish that he used to be a bandit. Reish Lakish gets upset and like goes mad and dies. And then Rabbi Yochanan is lonely and misses his chabruta. They bring someone else for him who starts agreeing with every point he says. And he says, when I used to learn with Reish Lakish, he would bring me, I think it's 24 kushiyot. I forget the exact number, like 24 difficulties to every point I'd make. He'd constantly tell me, no, you're wrong for A, B, C, D. You're like, these are all the reasons why you're wrong. And Rabbi Yochanan says to this new student, like, you're just... I don't need you to tell me I'm right. I know I'm right. I need you to tell me I'm wrong. Right? And they can't find someone else for him. And so he goes crazy and they pray for him to die. And he dies also. Just like a wild Gemara. And the famous expression in that. Right. Yeah. The famous expression in that Gemara is O chavruta o mituta. Either study partner or death. Yeah, it's the Aramaic form of mate. And like that's how strongly we think about the value of argumentation, of the milchamta shel Torah, the fighting of Torah. And I think the important question now is, like, where does this come from? And what's the origin of this kind of machloket, this kind of debate? And if you look at the next verse, Tosefta and Chagiga, seems to be rooted in a specific moment in Jewish history. So Pauline, do you want to read us verse 2?
Yes. I just was thinking, actually,
yeah,
about suppose there was no machloket. Suppose whichever honored sage said something, and people just said, well, this is it. So they wouldn't be living a life. They wouldn't be thinking or learning.
Hmm. Yeah.
And if they did, they would have to keep it to themselves. On pain of chop of your head.
Yeah. We're going to get back to that point, actually. That exact point is made by the Maharal of Prague. So we'll get there. We'll get there soon.
Rabbi Yossi said, in the beginning, there was no argument in Israel. Rather, the rabbinical court of 71 was in the chamber of the hewn stone, and the other courts of 23 were in the cities of the land of Israel. From the time that the students of Shammai and Hillel increased, who did not apprentice properly, arguments increased in Israel, and two Torahs of difference.
Great question, right? What are those two Torahs? So it sounds like, I want to go back to a few points in this piece, in the Tosefta and Chagiga, but the two Torahs, I think the simple reading of this Tosefta is that there's the Torah of the house of Shammai, and that there's the Torah of the house of Hillel. And this seems to be a real criticism. Seems to be a real critique, because for the rabbis worked tirelessly to unify the Jewish people, right? Sometimes this even led to bloodshed. We know that, you know, in the Second Temple period, you had, as an example, the Stukim versus the Prushim, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, who were really butting heads about what the correct interpretation of Torah was. We know that the Essenes had a third opinion, and they went down to the Dead Sea and, you know, kind of went off in their own direction of how to interpret Judaism. So we had these real, during the Second Temple period in particular, real, like, I wouldn't say the flourishing, because it's not viewed in a positive light, but a real, like, increase of different factions who had different opinions. So much so that the Gemara interprets the verse in the Torah of Lo Tizkoredu. Right? There's a verse in the Torah which, in its original context, means do not cut up your skin. Because there used to be this pagan practice that in mourning, a mourning rite would be to cut a person's skin. The rabbis interpret that homiletically and say, Lo tasu agudot agudot. Don't make yourselves into separate factions, because it's like cutting yourself up. They were very concerned about that, cutting yourself up. And I think this is a criticism here, right? That because Shammai and Hillel couldn't see eye to eye, right? They took one Torah and they split it into two. That's a strong critique. This Tosefta does not think well of the students of Hillel and Shammai. How do we know that? Because if you look, or at least the simple reading of this Tosefta does not look well at them. How do we know that? Because the language is here, Misharabu Talmidei Shammai v'Hillel. I'm just reading in the Hebrew so we can be more precise. When the students of Shammai and Hillel became great in number, Shelo Shimshu Kol Tzorchan, they did not do Shimush the whole way. They didn't do enough Shimush. Shimush normally means apprenticeship. I think there's an expression that says, Havi Mishamish Talmidei Shimush Talmidei Chachamim, that like apprenticing scholars is itself like a very holy thing to do, and you can learn a lot just by following around scholars and helping them out. It seems like they didn't follow along Shammai and Hillel enough. They didn't do enough work. They didn't study hard enough, maybe. Something was wrong with their behavior, and consequentially, there was machloket, more debates, and then the Torah almost split into two. And we know from sources that the houses of Hillel and Shammai, I mean, thousands of machlokot, of debates between them about how to practice Jewish law. It's a miracle that we survived that major debate. The Mishnah in Yevamot says that, thankfully, despite the fact that there were these really major debates, often about what constitutes Jewish identity, they still found ways that their families could marry each other. Right? The Mishnah says that. So, like, fortunately, we didn't fall apart entirely, but we basically had two different ways of practicing Judaism between the debates of Hillel and Shammai. And that's a strong critique. I want to also contrast that with the way the Tosefta frames the good old days. Because right? The way the Tosefta frames the good old days is back when we had the court of 71 and the small courts of 23. So let's just frame that. 71...
Is that the Sanhedrin?
Exactly, yeah. So 71 is the Sanhedrin HaGdola, the great Sanhedrin court. And it said, tells you where that was, and I think the location is important. It was in the Lishkat HaGazit, in the Chamber of Hewn Stone. That was a room on the side of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. Right? So the second temple of Judaism, right? The Sanhedrin, the primary court of the Jewish people, was in the temple where we were bringing offerings to Hashem. Right? Think about the imagery then. Right? If you're going back to the way we decide halacha, it's like from the place where we meet God is where the law emerges from. Right? It's a much more kind of divine-centered law. Does that make sense? The location, I think, is indicative of that. And the 71-person court and the 23-person courts, so 23 was the smallest halachic court where corporal or capital punishment could be administered. So these courts had like a higher level of authority. And the way that this Tosefta's framing it is, those were the good old days when a Beit Din could make a decision and everyone would agree, even if it had drastic consequences, right? And now, unfortunately, this is the way it's framed here, right? We don't have that anymore. So what do we have to do? We have to study and do the best we can. And unfortunately, our best isn't good enough, which is why the Torah has been split into two. See, it seems to be, I think this is a critical Gemara, that because we weren't studious enough, we ended up getting to Machloket. The students, Hillel and Shammai lived at the turn of the millennia, like the very end of the first century BCE into the first century CE. And so their students are really kind of growing in number right around the time of the destruction of the first temple, around 70 Common Era. Second temple, thank you. Which it's interesting that the Gemara says that the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, because of hatred, right, baseless hatred. So Machloket has this much more, meta consequence. It has a much more cosmic significance that it even leads to the destruction of the temple itself. So it's not thought of in such a good light by Chazal. There's definitely a negativity to debate. I'm just going to share another perspective about when debate was really born. When Machloket was born, because I think to see it just as Hillel and Shammai and their students, you can go deeper than that. And this is based in part from some learning I've been doing with the podcaster of Rabbi Ari Bergman. I met him years ago in Long Island. He is he founded a hedge fund that was like his primary career, and then in addition to managing his hedge fund, was always a serious, like, amazing Talmud Chacham Torah scholar, and went back to get his PhD in Talmud while still managing a hedge fund. So I don't know how a person does that, but he did that, and he's an incredible, incredible person. And he points out that really Judaism has two historical periods. There's the period, basically, of biblical Judaism, and then there's the period of rabbinic Judaism. There's the period where, and this is going back to the idea of like prophecy falling off and not listening to prophecy anymore. Instead, we listen to the rabbis, right? And that shift between the world of the Bible and the world of Chazal happens really with Ezra bringing back the Jews from the 70-year exile after the destruction of the First Temple in around 500 BCE. And then during the Second Temple period, you have the prototype of what we now call rabbis, which is Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the men of the Great Assembly. And during that period in time, you have a major transition towards a new shape of Judaism. We call it Rabbinic Judaism. The Gemara, you see hints of this in the Gemara. So I'm not going to quote the Gemara for you now. If you want, you can read it later. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 21b and 22a, it's source 3, goes so far as to say that if Moshe had not received the Torah, Ezra was holy enough that he could have also received the Torah. Ezra could have brought the Torah down to earth. It's an interesting expression. And the Gemara quotes lots of verses to show parallels between the book of Ezra and parallels of how the Torah speaks about Moshe. They both seem to hear God or bring God to earth in a similar way. So there's some parallelism between Ezra and Moshe. And the Gemara actually goes to say that really Ezra did in a sense give us the Torah. Why? Because until Ezra, the Torah was written in different script. It was written in the original Hebrew script. And then Ezra decided when he brought the Jews back to Israel in about 500 BCE that this Torah, we would change the font, the script of the Torah. It would no longer be Ketav Ivri, which is the original like ancient Israelite script, which almost looks a little bit like hieroglyphics. And it would now be the script that we recognize, which is called Ketav Ashuri, Assyrian script. Basically brought the font from Babylon, or from Persia, later Babylon, back from exile, and changed the script of the Torah. Why does that matter? Why would he do such a thing? So on a really simple level, the average Jew could not read Ketav Ivri. So the average Jew, even if they could read, were illiterate from reading the Bible itself, the Torah itself. So he changed the script of the Torah and made the Torah legible to everyone, or to everyone who could read at least, right? That's a major transition. That's like a bringing the Torah down to the people, right? So now you can understand the kind of parallelisms between Moshe and Ezra. Moshe brings down the Torah in its original form. Ezra brings down the Torah to the average person. The book of Ezra says that Ezra gave a beor, gave a commentary on the Torah. Seems to be maybe the first reference to a text we have that we would call a Torah Shebaal Peh, an oral tradition, a commentary on the original Torah itself. And what Rabbi Ari Bergman points out from this is that it's really in the time of Ezra, and the return to Israel, the second exodus, really, instead of from Egypt this time, it's the exodus from Babylon, or I guess Persia at that point. This is around the time that the Purim story happens also. So we come back to Israel, not everyone, but some people, and there's this, not translation, but there's a rewriting of the Torah into script that everyone could read. And there's the commentary that's given to the Torah. This is a shift between seeking God in prophecy, because until that point, the major communications we had with God were through the words of the Nevi'im, the prophets, who proved themselves with miracles. Right? And there's a shift away from miracles, away from prophecy, and now we're not going to find God in these divine communications or these miraculous events, the jumping of the carob trees. Right? We're going to now start to find God in the words of the text itself. Right? So Rabbi Ari Bergman quotes some earlier historians of comparative religion, but this was actually happening in lots of different religions around the same time. The term that was coined is it's the axial age. There's a shift in the access of how man meets God. And it's a shift away from ritualistic kind of encounters into an intellectual pursuit, that we meet God with our minds and not with our bodies in the same way, or not with kind of some ritual that we hope to lead to some prophetic encounter. So there's a major shift in world religion, and it's fascinating to see that this is internal to our Mesorah, to our tradition. This is what was happening in Judaism as well. Right? You have the temple is still there for another 500 years, but there's a second Beit HaMikdash. But the second temple, we already know from the Mishnah, didn't have miracles in it, or didn't have the same level of miracles. Right? So the first temple, when there was a korban, when there was, let's say, an incense offering, right? The tradition is that the offering would go up in a straight pillar, would go straight up to heaven. And now that miracle didn't happen anymore. We didn't have the cherubs, the kerubim. We didn't have the Urim Bitumim. The Urim Bitumim were in the first temple, right? It was behind the breastplate. It was these inscriptions of God's names that would light up the breastplate, and the breastplate with the 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel would basically, like, it was almost like prophetic word. It would like light up different letters, or it would basically give us prophetic messages. That was in the first temple, wasn't in the second temple. We like started weaning ourselves off of prophecy, and it's also that time that you have the ascendancy of Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, who were not, well, primarily, actually, the way that Chazal portrayed is that it was majority rabbis and minority prophets, like 85 rabbis and 35 prophets is the way the Gemara describes it. So you have this weaning off of prophecy. And as you have the weaning off of prophecy, what God wants is really clear, right? Because God tells you so, right? When Isaiah goes and tells the Jews, right, if you don't stop worshiping idols, then you're going to get kicked out of the land, and God told me so. When Jonah goes to Nineveh and says, another 30 days and Nineveh will be destroyed, right? How do I know? God said so. Right? And now it's, what did God say? Let's talk about it. How did you read that verse? Right? What did that mean to you? How do you interpret that? Right? And it's that shift from hearing God or seeing God in action to thinking about God and processing God with your own mind that I think that's really the origin of machloket, right? Because opinions can always differ from each other, as opposed to seeing one objective prophetic image, right? If there's a prophecy, you can't really debate what God said. You can question the validity of the prophet, but once you accept the prophet's once you accept the validity of a prophet, you can't really argue with the message. And that's a major shift. On the one hand, you could see that as a tragedy, right? On the other hand, maybe through that loss of prophecy, maybe new opportunity is born. So let's take it to the next step, the mechanics of rabbinic machloket. I'm going to, for the sake of time, summarize this part also. This is fascinating. The Rambam, in his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah, the Perush HaMishnayot, the Rambam goes extensively, and it's available in English on Sepharia, through the five categories of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral tradition. And what the Rambam is really careful about, because the Rambam, we have principles about the oral tradition, is that some things do come from Mount Sinai. Right? There's the concept of Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai, right? An oral tradition that goes back to Moses at Mount Sinai. An example of that might be, you know, how do you know that tefillin is supposed to be black? Right, like how do you know it's not supposed to be purple, right? Well, that's a halacha l'Moshe M'Sinai. That's a law that goes back to Moses at Mount Sinai. There are other examples as well. The explanation of some difficult words in the Bible. Some of those have a Sinaitic tradition to them as well. But now the Rambam gets to his third of three of five categories of the oral tradition, and in that category he says that there is what we call. Laws that are learned with derech hasvara, through the path of the intellect, the path of logic. This might be an example. An example of this might be, you know, if the law is the case in an easier case, an a priori argument, what we call kal v'chomer in the Gemara. So if, let's say, a law is true about Yom Tov, which categorically is less strict than Shabbat, then if you know it's true about Yom Tov, all the more so that law would be true about Shabbat, because Shabbat is stricter than Yom Tov. Right, that would be an example of an a priori argument. That's a svara. That's an example of rabbinic logic. So what the Rambam says is anything that is a matter of tradition, going back to Mount Sinai, something that's passed down from generation to generation to Mount Sinai, that there's no such thing as machloket. Basically, the Rambam says, if there is a debate about something, you know that it's not from Har Sinai. If you find a debate in the Gemara, you know that it's not about Mount Sinai. That's complicated. You could spend hours about this, because there are actually machlokot. There are debates all throughout the Gemara of, well, how do you say that this verse teaches you X? I say that this verse teaches you Y. Okay, we'll leave that for now. But in principle, the Rambam says that when we start to deduce laws based on our intellect and our logic, that's where machlokot begins. Let's go to the next page. He quotes the idea that it's when Hillel and Shammai started arguing that it's when Hillel and Shammai, their students, began that arguments and debates started emerging. So Sheldon, do you want to read from the fifth line of the second page there? But when the diligence?
Well, when the diligence of the students towards wisdom slackened and their reasoning weakened in comparison to the reasoning of Hillel and Shammai, disagreement occurred among them in the investigation of many things, as the reasoning of each and every one of them was according to his intellect and to what he had in hand in the fundamentals. And nonetheless, they should not be blamed, as we cannot force two sages that debate in investigation to debate according to the intellect of Yehoshua and Pinchas. And likewise, we have no doubt about that which they debated, just because they are not like Shammai and Hillel or like those before them, as the Holy One, blessed be He, did not command His service in this manner.
Okay, so I think the main point of that paragraph, okay, is that, you know what, when we saw that Tosefta that says that when did Machloka begin? In the days of the students of Hillel and Shammai. And why? Because Lo Shimshu, they didn't do enough work. They didn't study hard enough, basically. Right? And the Rambam says, you know what? Kacha. Right? It is what it is. Don't be upset with them for it. Right? You can't hold them to the standards of those who came before them. The Rambam is implying here the principle we call Yerida Hadorot, the descent of the generations, that the further you are from Mount Sinai, intellectually, spiritually, you descend a little bit further because you're a little bit further from revelation. But he's like, what can we do? Right? It is what it is. These are the sages of that generation. They do their best, but unfortunately, because they're, if their intellects were higher, if they were smarter or at least closer to God, then they wouldn't have argued. They would have both, they would have all been able to agree. Unfortunately, right, Tsarenu, to our disgrace, they're not so holy. They're not so smart. Therefore, they don't agree on everything. The Rambam sees this almost as an unfortunate consequence, an unavoidable consequence of history. Like, the further you are from Mount Sinai, the harder it is to just get along and to agree on everything. But the next paragraph, and I'll paraphrase it, is he quotes the verse in Devarim that we're still obligated to just listen to the sages of each generation. Don't feel like you need to somehow hearken back to earlier generations because we're not smart enough or holy enough. The verse in Devarim, it says, chapter 17, El ha-shofet asher yehu b'yamim ahem. You should listen to the judge who is in those days, right? You deal with what you have. If you don't have the smartest judge on earth, right, then that's okay too. God's all right with that. Yeah.
Pauline. So we are so far from Sinai.
Yeah.
That we have so many wise and learned people who give us their perspective.
Yeah. We're going to see that. I agree with you.
Sometimes that bothers me.
Yeah.
And the reason is when I learned about being a Jew.
Yeah.
And was in school. That sort of set me in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I keep to that.
You're schooling.
And sometimes, right. And sometimes I don't like to be told a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's not the correct expression.
Yeah.
But I want to stay with what sits well with me.
Yeah.
My understanding.
I hear. It's hard to complicate our understandings.
Because I think that it gives you a certain kind of peace also. But mm-hmm. also you lose the knowledge and you lose the open window that is there for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to get back because I'm actually going to make a note.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a note about that.
All right, so
I think, going back to the Rambam, I think it's important that to like understand from the Rambam's perspective, right, machloket, debate, is not like the ideal, right? So I think what you're expressing, right, that tension of like if you only know what you know, if you only know one way, then there's something comforting and secure about that. I think that's what the Rambam was like trying to speak out also. Right? Back in the good old days when we heard the prophet of God who told us exactly what Hashem wanted of us, you live with a certainty that I'm doing what I'm really... that I am living up to what God wants of me in this world. It's simple and it's beautiful and it's and you don't have to live with doubts in your mind. I think that's kind of what you were expressing, right?
People will say, I don't know what the right thing is.
Yeah.
I don't have that. In many ways.
Wow.
Some ways I want to learn more, but
yeah.
I'm centered.
And what I think...
I needed that.
It's good. If only we could all be a center.
May you be old like your mother and older.
If only we could all be as centered as you are, Polly. We're going to see that, you know, with the loss of that certainty and that maybe even that centeredness, right? Because we do sometimes deal with not knowing and hearing multiple truths and not knowing how to actually make sense of them. There's opportunity with that confusion also. And I think that's what we're going to see. That I don't think that's the Rambam's perspective. I think the Rambam's perspective is really hearkening to how beautiful the good old days were, right? I legitimately think that that's what the Rambam was saying. But we'll see that there's something else in our tradition also. And the Rambam doesn't express it here, but this is the famous line in Erevin that talks about the debates of Hillel and Shammai, that there was this three-year standstill between Hillel and Shammai and between the houses of Hillel and Shammai in the Beit Midrash. And they couldn't like agree on anything. Until, and interestingly enough, the bat kol, the sound from heaven that we rejected in the story of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua earlier, the bat kol here is what decides the halacha. And what the Bakhul says, it's these famous words, it's source 5 and Erev in 13b, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim, both these and these are the words of the living God, right? V'halacha k'beit Hillel. And the practice law should be according to Beit Hillel. So you could spend a year trying to unpack that one phrase. Right? What is that? Are there multiple truths? Is truth a spectrum that you can only like see parts of it from different perspectives? Right? Does God hold opposite truths within him? Right? How do you make sense of this phrase? So for today, I just want to kind of share one perspective about what this means. So there's a fascinating expression in, and now we're going to kind of move into the theology of debate of machloket, because what I think is fascinating about our tradition is that we put God into the center of our arguments, right? Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim. If you're really arguing for the sake of heaven, right, that argument holds. It's the word of God. Both sides are the words of God, right? We think that argumentation in its best form is divine, and so let's try to think of a theology of machloket. Like how God fits into our debates and our arguments. So the Gemara in Chagiga, and I don't think I had known this Gemara, or at least not well before, quotes interesting verse in Kohelet. This is verse 6. Allison, I'm going to ask you to read it in a minute, but first I'll just read this verse. The verse in Kohelet in Ecclesiastes says, Divrei Chachamim kedarvonot, that the words of the sages are like darvonot. I didn't know what that meant, so I looked at the translation, goads. Didn't know what that meant either. I don't know if you know what a goat is.
Yeah.
It's a metal stick to prod sheep. So the words of the sages are like prods, basically. Keep sticking into you, like making you uncomfortable. Ukimas mirot nituyim, and like nails that are stuck into balei asufot, into prodding sticks. Okay? And then, nitnu meroe echad. They were given by one shepherd. Okay. Like many verses in Kohelet, like what on earth does that mean? So Chazal, the rabbis in the Talmud in Chagiga 3b, they read one of those lines, Ba'alei Asufot, not as prodding sticks, but Ba'alei, the owners of Asufot. Asufot comes from the word Asaf, Le'esof, to collect or to gather. Okay, so they're going back to the beginning of the verse and interpreting it homiletically. The beginning of the verse was Divrei Chachamim, the words of the sages. So we learn something from this verse about how sages collect their words. How do sages talk? They talk as Ba'alei Asufot, as the owners of piles or gatherings. As in, when sages get together, they end up gathering in different groups, right, in multiple groups or clusters. That's what the Gemara seems to interpret out of this. So, Allison, can you read us the Gemara in Chagiga, source 7? Or Don, did you read it?
No, she did.
Oh, so Don, why don't you read that for us? Yeah.
Those that are composed in collections, Ba'alei Asufot, these are Torah scholars who sit in many groups, Asufot, and engage in Torah study. There are often debates among these groups, as some of these sages render an object or person ritually impure, and these render it pure. These prohibit an action, and these permit it. These deem an item invalid, and these deem it valid. Lest a person say, now how can I study Torah when it contains so many different opinions? The verse states that they are all given from one shepherd. One God gave them one leader, i.e. Moses, sent them from the mouth of the master of all creation. Blessed be he, as it is written, and God spoke all these words. The plural form words indicates that God transmitted all the interpretations of the Ten Commandments. Since the sages invariably utilize the Torah itself or the statements of the prophets as the sources for their opinions, there is a certain unity to the study of Torah, despite the numerous explanations and applications.
It's a beautiful Gemara, because what it says is, you know, in some ways in the theory of Torah study, because we're always rooting it in psukim, in verses. But just as we believe that the Torah comes from one place, so do we believe that all the opinions of how to interpret the Torah comes from that same one place. And so we have a lot of expressions for how to say that. One famous expression is shivim panim la Torah. There are 70 faces to the Torah, maybe 70 expressions of the Torah into the world. There's a midrash that says that for every possible debate, it's either midrash or gemara, there are 49 reasons to say permitted and 49 reasons to say forbidden for any one kind of thing. And they all come from Roeh Echad, from one shepherd, right? From Moses, who brought them down, from the ultimate shepherd, right? Which is God. And so, you know, it's a pretty deep way. It's counterintuitive. It's hard for a human mind to, like, really access it. Because in our experience of machloket, of debate, it's like, if I'm right, how can you not be wrong? Right? Our human character, like, forces us to really think in balei asufot, in, like, disparate groups, right? Human nature does not see the world from an elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, that two contradictory opinions can come from one unified God. Right? But if you think that everything out of the Torah, it's almost like the Torah is a fountain, and it's like streams outward. And sometimes the fountain will kind of cascade into different streams, or different kind of, streams or funnels or, but where does it all come from? It's all coming from the same source, right? It's a beautiful way to think about Torah. It's kind of like emanating from one unified place. And that's really going back to Moshe and Har Sinai. It reminds me of the story of Moshe, who, when God says he can't enter the land of Israel, God takes him, according to the Midrash, on this tour of Jewish history. Has anyone heard this? So it's based on the words of the Torah that God said, I will show you the land, but you can't enter it. And so what's God showing Moshe? According to the Midrash, it's God showing Moshe the future of Jewish history. And so according to this Midrash, one of the places they stop in this magical mystery tour is into the Beit Midrash, the study hall of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva starts expounding all the crowns on the letters of the Torah. And so if you look at a Torah scroll, you'll see that some of the letters, not all of them, I think it's Manzapach, it's like a number of the Hebrew letters, will have special crowns on the top of them. We don't write modern Hebrew this way, but you'll find it in a Torah scroll. And we believe that which letters get crowns is a halacha l'Moshe miSinai. It's a law that goes back to Moses at Mount Sinai. But Moses never knew why they were there. And he hears Rabbi Akiva starting to expound laws based on which letters have crowns and which letters don't have crowns. And apparently, according to the Midrash, Moshe gets really upset. He's like, I don't understand what he's talking about. And finally, at the end of the lesson, God is still there with Moshe. And finally, Moshe hears a student ask Rabbi Akiva, where did you get this from? And Rabbi Akiva says, Halacha l'Moshe miSinai. Right? I learned this from the laws of Moses at Mount Sinai. And Moshe finally felt better. It's like Moshe didn't even know all the places his Torah would go. Right? But it still came from Moshe. Right? Moshe is the fountain, right? Is the source, the origin of the fountain. And it all comes from Moshe, who got it from God. Right? So there's a unity in origin, and that's part of what unifies all the different opinions and all the different laws that are learned later. And so now to go into the theology of it in our Greek Jewish thinkers, these are both my translations, and so if they're not good, I apologize. And maybe I'll just summarize them, because better to summarize them than butcher the translation. But if you want to take them and hold them on for later, that's fine. So the Maharal of Prague, one of the great Jewish sages, Rabbi Yehuda Loy, had this amazing commentary on the same statement that the debates of Hillel and Shammai got into this gridlock until we heard the words Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. And what he says, actually, let me back up. I think theologically, there's real beauty into thinking, you know, often we think of God as this simple figure, right? We simplify God in our minds. I don't know. I think many of us simplify God into this perception of an old guy with a big beard, right? That's a simplification, right? It's also trying to concretize God into something that is far simpler than God could possibly be. I always like to think of, I actually find a lot of comfort in how complex God must be. Right? Because I believe that this world is a creation of God. And I see how complicated the world itself is. In just in terms of like the immense, infinite number of scientific laws that govern the way that the universe functions and that our world functions. And then the amount of often the experience of chaos that exists in the world and how everything seems unordered and unfair. And for me, like, it's a reflection of how complicated God must actually be. And I think we often meet God in complexity. And that's actually how the Maharal explains the idea of machloket in Judaism as well. The Maharal says that the real truth, real emet, is not that there is that there's one perspective that is better than all others. Real truth is that every word of Torah, every law of the Torah, contains within it a multitude of laws or a multitude of contradictory opinions. And practice is defined by what we saw at the first story of Achrei Rabbi Mahatot, of majority rules. Jewish practice is defined by that. But practice is not truth. Right, and this is a difficult thing to hold on to. Halacha, Jewish communal accepted practice, does not necessarily equal the wholeness of God's emet, of God's truth, right? Because God's truth is so much bigger than any one set of practices could ever hold in, could ever hold. And so that's why when you think of the expression of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chayim, these and these are the words of a living God, God can hold all of that into one complicated, nuanced truth. We might only live out a small part of that spectrum, right? But the truth of God, the truth of God's revelation in the Torah, which, as our sages say, is almost an emanation of God itself, is so much wider than anything we can encounter. And just to take this to one last point, there's a statement at the end of Shabbos davening that we say, and it's, you know, if you're thinking about Jewish jokes, this is one of the best ones. It's a statement that says, Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Be'olam, that Torah scholars bring peace to the world. Which is, like, hilarious if you've ever been into, like, a Beit Midrash, because, like, there's nothing peaceful going on there. Like, there's argumentation and, like, the Milchamta Shel Torah, the war of Torah that's being waged in the study halls. And unfortunately, we see too many examples of, like, real war being created between factions of Torah scholars nowadays. I mean, unfortunately, you only have to look at the Jewish news websites to see that Torah scholars are subject sometimes to the same arguments would be a nice way to put it, but really the same factionizing and politics and discrediting each other that everyone else is. And so it's kind of a joke. So Rav Kook asks the question, like, what does that mean, that Torah scholars bring peace to the world? And if you look, that statement in our prayers, we say it at the end of the repetition in Musaf. The verse that proves it is a verse in Isaiah that says, V'chol banayich limudei Hashem v'rav shalom banayich, that all of your children, that's how it's often translated, will be students of God, and great will be peace among your children. And so the Gemara here that's quoted in our Siddur, it's the Gemara Brachot, says, Al tikre banayich, ela bonayich. Don't read the word as your children, but rather read the word as your builders, right? Those who build. So who are builders? Right? Those are Talmidei Chachamim, the Torah scholars who build peace in the world. Okay, fascinating, kind of hilarious statement when you think about, like, whether that reflects our perceived reality. And Rav Kook says that, like, we all make mistakes about how to interpret that verse because none of us really understand what shalom, what real peace is. And Rav Kook says we assume that peace is when we can all, when we all get along because we all do the same thing. It's basically what Rav Kook says. We assume that shalom will be, right, when everyone, you know, prepares the same Shabbos foods and everyone dresses the exact same way and lives the identical homogeneous life. That's when we're going to have real peace. We'll all get along because we'll have nothing to disagree about because we'll all be doing the same thing. And Rav Kook says that that's a misunderstanding of what shalom really is. That he says real shalom, he uses the term of ribui shalom. Real peace is when you achieve abundance in peace. And for him, ribui, abundance or lot, like the expansion, doesn't mean like abundance of many, many copies of one thing, but it's when you can kind of have multiple different kinds of things living together. Real shalom is not when everyone's uniform. Real shalom, real peace, is when everyone is a little bit different and we get along in our differences. That's real shalom. And Rav Kook says, and this is so beautiful, this is really the job of Talmidei Chachamim, of scholars. The job of scholars is to try to interpret things from different perspectives, to try to actually dig out the different truths that are contained within God's Torah. The work of a Torah scholar is to say, I want to understand the depth of Hillel, of Beit Hillel, and the depth of Beit Shammai, and all of the logic that went into their opinions, and why they disagreed with each other, and then realize that God's in both of them. Right? To find the divinity and diversity of opinion. That's when you build a shalom. That's how Torah scholars build peace. Not by agreeing, but by specifically finding God and exposing God by learning differences of opinions. And even sometimes living them as well. So may we all, in our own encounter of machloket, of diversity of opinions, feel, you know, have the space to disagree, hopefully to disagree agreeably, which is easier said than done. And in the next few weeks, we'll talk about the paradigm of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Why do we actually follow the opinions of Hillel as opposed to the opinions of Shammai? Maybe will that one day change? Maybe. I hear you. And then in future weeks, we'll talk about cases where the Jewish world is really rocked by major machloket, major debate in Jewish practice, and how the rabbis think about where are the edges, where are the limits to machloket, and how do you deal with machloket when it's gone too far? Because we've seen this tension already. There's something beautiful, and it can be overwhelming and confusing at the same time. Thanks everyone for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Colin.